ranging from 5,300 meters up to 8,440 meters high. The article you're about to hear has been written by journalist Damien Carrington, environment editor for The Guardian. The piece is titled "Microplastic Pollution Found Near Summit of Mount Everest." Please stay with us for more of Damien Carrington's article. Microplastic pollution has been discovered in snow close to the peak of Mount Everest, the world's highest mountain. With plastic debris revealed in 2018 at the deepest point on Earth, the Mariana Trench in the Pacific Ocean, it is now clear that humanity's litter has polluted the entire planet. The tiny plastic fibers were found within a few hundred meters of the top of the 8,850-meter-high mountain, at a spot known as the Balcony. Microplastics were found in all snow samples collected from 11 locations on Mount Everest, ranging from 5,300 meters high to 8,440 meters high. The highest concentrations of microplastics were found around base camp, where climbers and trekkers spend most of their time. The microplastic fibers were most likely to have come from clothing, tents and ropes used by mountaineers, scientists and others. Other recent discoveries of microplastic pollution in remote parts of the Swiss Alps and French Pyrenees indicate that particles can also be carried by wind from further afield. It really surprised me to find microplastics in every single snow sample I analysed, said Imogen Napper, the University of Plymouth, who led the new research. Imogen Napper added, "Mount Everest is somewhere I have always considered remote and pristine. To know we are polluting near the top of the tallest mountain on Earth is a real eye-opener. With microplastics so ubiquitous in our environment, it's time to focus on appropriate environmental solutions," she said. "We need to protect and care for our planet." Reducing, reusing and recycling larger items of plastic waste is important, according to Imogen Napper, as they can be broken down into microplastics when discarded into the environment. But many microplastics are shed from clothing made from synthetic fibers, synthetic fabrics, and she said a focus on better fabrics was needed, as well as using natural fibers such as cotton. Millions of tons of plastic are lost into the environment every year. It can contain toxic additives and carry harmful microbes and is known to injure wildlife that mistakes it for food. People also consume microplastics via food and water and breathe them in, although the health impact on humans is not yet known. There have been long-standing concerns about litter on Mount Everest, which was climbed by at least 880 individuals in 2019. But the new study is the first of its kind to assess microplastic pollution on Mount Everest, which is less than 5 millimeters in size, and therefore the microplastic is too small to be picked up. The study, published in the journal One Earth, analyzed samples collected by a National Geographic expedition in 2019. The scientists found an average of 30 microplastic particles per liter of water in the snow samples and 119 particles per liter of water in the most contaminated sample. They also assessed stream water samples from 8 locations, but only 3 had microplastics, perhaps as the streams were able to wash away contamination. In her previous work, Imogen Napper had found that each cycle of a washing machine can release 700,000 microscopic plastic fibers, and that plastic bags that claimed to be biodegradable were still intact after 3 years in the natural environment. Microplastic and nanoplastic particles are now discoverable in human organs, thanks to a new technique which has been developed. Microplastics have polluted the entire planet, from Arctic snow and alpine soils to the deepest oceans. People are also known to consume them via food and water and to breathe them in, but their potential impact on human health is not yet known. The researchers expect to find the particles in human organs and have identified chemical traces of plastic in tissue. But isolating and characterizing such minuscule fragments is difficult, and contamination from plastics in the air is also a challenge. To test their technique, they added particles to 47 samples of lung, liver, spleen, and kidney tissue obtained from a tissue bank established to study neurodegenerative diseases. Their results showed that the microplastics could be detected in virtually every sample. The scientists, whose work is being presented at a meeting of the American Chemical Society, said their technique would enable other researchers to determine contamination levels in human organs around the world. It would be naive to believe that there is a plastic everywhere, but not in us, according to Rolf Holden of Arizona State University. Rolf Holden added, "We are now providing a research platform that will allow us and others to look for what is invisible. These microplastic particles too small for the naked eye to see. The risk to health really resides in the small particles." The analytical methods developed allows the researchers to identify dozens of types of plastic, including the polyethylene terephthalate, or PET, used in plastic drink bottles, and the polyethylene used in plastic bags. They found bisphenol A, or BPA, a chemical used to make plastics, in all 47 samples. The U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, is concerned about BPA because it is a reproductive, developmental, and systematic toxicant in animal studies. The researchers examined lung, liver, spleen, and kidney tissue, as these organs are likely to be exposed to microplastic particles or to collect them. Charles Rolski, another member of the team which issued the report, said, "In a few short decades, we have gone from seeing plastic as a wonderful benefit to considering it as a threat. Microplastics are those less than 5 millimeters in diameter, and nanoplastics have a diameter of less than 1/1000th of a millimeter. Both form largely from the abrasion of larger pieces of plastic dumped into the environment. Research in wildlife and laboratory animals has linked exposure to tiny plastic particles to infertility, inflammation, and even cancer."
Thank God Corona is kind to kids, relatively, because sanctions aren't. Kids with cancer are dying in Iran from lack of medicine, as mostly adults are dying in their thousands per month from COVID-19. US sanctions are killing people where the coronavirus wouldn't have. Trump's USA tried to blame the pandemic's death toll in Iran on the Iranian government for corruption and incompetence. But that only doubles the sins of the U.S. for both unleashing medical terror on this country and blaming the victim. That's not to say Iran hasn't made its fair share of mistakes, but not much can compare to the toll U.S. sanctions have taken on the economy of this country and hence the fight on COVID-19. To trace where the blame leads to, stay with me, Leila Faramarzi, on Iran Today. To go off on a tangent, the U.S. is one to talk about incompetence, with a president or outgoing president prescribing bleach as a corona cure.
Right, and then I see the disinfectant, where it knocks it out in a minute, 1 minute. And is there a way we can do something like that by injection inside or almost a cleaning? Because you see it gets on the lungs and it does a tremendous number of lungs, so it'd be interesting to check there.
Whatever incompetence Iran may have displayed, it pales next to that of the U.S., and Iran is in a quagmire. Maximum pressure economic sanctions cannot not have hit the economy. They have contributed to a drastic currency devaluation and high inflation. But not to tip the scales, let's begin with domestic causes of the disease having peaked in this West Asian state more than in neighboring states. Let's hear it from the dean of a successful hospital in corona care, who also has in his care kids with cancer. That would be Dr. Abul Ghasemi of Bariatullah Hospital.
The reason for the coronavirus spread in Iran was that we couldn't stop the source at the early stages. The best time to stop the virus from spreading was during the Iranian New Year's holidays. We should have taken more stringent measures like the ones in the Eastern Bloc. The model we chose was unfortunately from the West, and you can see how bad the situation they are in. We need to focus on the carriers of the virus. Testing hospitalized patients doesn't help much. Instead, we should go and test those who are healthy carriers and who have been in contact with them, and then give them facilities so that we can isolate them in hotels, provide them with vacant government houses, and use the money raised by charity to assist them.
Dr. Abul Ghasemi sees sanctions as a blessing as well as a curse. He takes pride in corona-related findings and domestic medicine that were achieved specifically to survive America's maximum pressure campaign. But that does not erase the greater evil.
Handling the coronavirus pandemic is not just a matter of providing medicine, but also a matter directly related to economics. That is, nations that want to control the crisis must have a stronger economy and stronger facilities. And these possibilities have been taken away from us by the West. They do not allow us to sell our oil. They do not allow us to take back the money foreigners owe us. They do not allow us to make our purchase on what we need, all of which have affected our economy.
Dr. Ghanei is a lung specialist and on the COVID-19 Studies Committee. You know, the most common grave danger of COVID-19 is the lungs getting severely engaged.
It is true that we are producing diagnostic test kits, but the problem is that the Ministry of Health cannot afford all these kits. I mean, for example, you see some countries that were very strong economically tested one person twice, but we, for example, could test maybe 350 people out of 100,000. So the number of our tests was down because of the financial problems that were imposed on us. This clearly indicates it.
As the coronavirus made it to its first birthday mid-November, it left in its wake the highest number of casualties Iran has yet seen. And from Saturday, the 22nd of November, the nation has gone into a two-week quarantine to be imposed. The government has announced quarantine of sorts in past, but it is not easy to maintain given the strain Iran's incarcerated economy has already endured. In the earlier days of the outbreak, when no one knew what they were facing, the world contributed to exacerbating the problem.
There were other practical mistakes made that don't necessarily relate to our country, but to the whole world. For example, they thought wearing face masks had no effect on curbing the spread. For a while, they said the transmission takes place through surfaces. And then they said for a while that the patients transmitted the virus, but then they realized that it wasn't entirely true, as they were isolated and everyone avoided them. We know today that most people who are infectious are seemingly healthy. Insufficient work was done on the matter, and not enough is being done now either.
In the earlier days of the outbreak, Iranian doctors boasted their success in improvising to help patients overcome the disease. Dr. Salehi, chief of the infectious diseases section of Imam Khomeini Hospital, has visited us again. This time, he laments losing the most patients ever to corona as a third wave of the virus surges on.
Why such fatality with COVID-19? Does it have to do with insufficient government measures or mostly people's non-observance of protocol?
As to why the number of deaths has increased and why the number of critically ill patients is so high, it is certainly due to the high influx of patients into the health system. If we are to assume that, for example, you have the ability to produce 3 TV shows a day, if it grows to 10 programs a day, how much does that impact the quality of your work? The same goes for us. For example, I have the ability to care for 30 patients a day. If this jumps to 90, I can't deal with my patients as carefully as I have to. This has actually happened. The main reason for the decline in the quality of the health system is a sharp increase in the number of patients.
According to official international sources, as of 23rd November 2020, globally, there are about 60 million coronavirus cases, about 1,400,000 deaths, and about 40,800,000 recovered. And in Iran, there are about 855,000 total cases, under 45,000 total deaths, and under 604,000 recovered. Like I said, there's been a surge in cases, and with more cases come more deaths, but also more treated. Treatment remains much the same.
We use antiviral drugs. For example, drugs such as favipiravir, remdesivir, and various other drugs. On the other hand, drugs such as dexamethasone and methylprednisolone are being used and have really helped some patients. But in general, none of these have been miraculous.
First of all, there is really no particular medicine to cure COVID-19, but there are procedures that we prescribe in clinical trials. One of the things we did to treat patients, like plasma therapy, was a project I started at this very hospital, and even the Americans started to adopt plasma therapy 2 or 3 weeks after us. Another important issue in handling COVID-19 patients is our oxygen supply. They even sanctioned us on this and refused to sell us oxygen generators. We started a knowledge-based company ourselves and produced oxygen.
But my question was, can patients get hold of the cure at reasonable prices? Because some hearsay reports paint a dismal picture. In August, the nation was angered by reports contrary to government claims. In April, the Iranian president Hassan Rouhani had said that the government and insurance department would pay 90% of treatment costs for COVID-19, leaving only 10% to citizens. Studies have shown that in private hospitals, the minimum cost of coronavirus treatment reaches 350 million rials. That's approximately $1,370 by the November 23rd exchange rate of 256,000 rials to the dollar. They say those costs can go up to 1.5 billion rials, which is under $5,900. And that is apart from the cost of private nurses and special medication. In public hospitals, on the other hand, treatment for insurance holders is almost free. But without insurance, a patient would have to pay between 50 and 300 million rials for treatment, which is close to $200 to $1,170.
We have a protocol in the scientific committee that you can prescribe certain drugs to people who are admitted. This is clear, so I will not discuss it. When we treat the patient with a scientific protocol, it costs about 5 million 2 months, which is affordable. Also, the insurance pays, and the majority of our patients are insured, and we have a bed for them too. However, some private hospitals perform procedure for the patients that have not been approved by the scientific committee, and the patient is willing to pay any amount in such life and death situations.
Helpful medicine aside, the world is now moving towards using a vaccine. Question is, will Iran make its own vaccine soon enough, because it's among the countries that have been working on it? If not, will Iran be able to place an international order and pay for it? Because we know that even if medicine were totally not under sanctions, banking sanctions have been enough to block Iran's payment channels. Because countries, companies, and banks fear that dealing with Iran would expose them to secondary U.S. sanctions.
Iran prepared itself for both scenarios. If another country could produce the vaccine sooner, we can buy it until our own vaccine can be prepared. But I'm sure that the vaccine projects that we have been working on in Iran are close to the final stage. We do not have a problem in terms of their effectiveness. Our problem is to prepare them for the mass production and shipping stage to be able to use them for ourselves. Several projects that I know of are underway in Iran and have achieved very good results. I think we will definitely have an Iranian vaccine by next year.
We are expecting the COVID vaccine to be mass-produced pretty soon. Would you say that would be a reliable vaccine, and will Iran be able to place an order? Can we pay for it? Do we have the right channels, access to the right channels to pay for it?
Instead of vaccines, I think we should focus on more definitive precautions, such as using face masks, washing hands, and social distancing. The unilateral and irrational U.S. sanctions against Iran and some other countries is another reality we need to face. I am optimistic about these political changes that are taking place in the United States. If Mr. Joe Biden takes the power from Donald Trump and becomes the next U.S. president, it seems that, as he has said in his campaign speeches, he is ready to return to the JCPOA. So I hope we can have vaccines in Iran more easily.
Sanctions are an inseparable part of life to Iranians who have been isolated by Western terms for the past 40 years. But the first hard blow came 10 years ago with nuclear-related economic UN sanctions on this country. In 2015, those were eased and were to be lifted in stages by the JCPOA or nuclear deal in return for Iran limiting its peaceful nuclear program. Iran did so. But come Donald Trump, hopes were shattered for Iran and other parties to the deal. The U.S. unilaterally pulled out and reimposed U.N. sanctions as U.S. sanctions on Iran. Call it illegal to have the U.S. deny it. Before carrying on with sanctions, let's take a look at other media outlets to see what they've got on offer. For that, I give you Shahrzad.
My name is Shahrzad Manoucheri, and we'll be reviewing the latest update on sanctions and the coronavirus pandemic, the U.S.'s blatant disregard for human lives. CBS News takes a look inside Iran's harrowing, sanctions-fueled coronavirus catastrophe. Iran is struggling with the worst coronavirus outbreak in the Middle East. Scientists at Tehran's Pasteur Institute are coordinating the national coronavirus testing efforts. Dr. Mostafa Salehi Vaziri's team managed to ramp up from just 10 tests per day to 30,000. It was an impressive improvement, but not enough to get control of the spiraling epidemic. The main hurdle for the lab hasn't been science, but politics. U.S.-led sanctions have choked off Iran's access to foreign-made chemicals and equipment. Vazi has been forced to work with what he's got, which is a shortage of virtually everything. Tehran Times reports 75 lawmakers call on Trump administration to ease sanctions on Iran. Democratic lawmakers have urged the President of the United States to show leniency and allow coronavirus aid to be sent to Iran as the White House drew up a plan to step up sanctions on Iran in the remaining weeks of Donald Trump's first term in office. In a letter to Treasury Secretary and Secretary of State this week, Representative Jesus Choi Garcia and Senator Elizabeth Warren, along with 73 other House and Senate Democrats, called on the Trump administration to issue a worldwide temporary general license that would cover testing kits, respirators, and personal protective equipment needed to combat the COVID-19 pandemic, the Foreign Policy magazine reported. The pandemic has laid bare the ways in which our broad application of sanctions is undermining public health systems, imposing sweeping economic penalties that restrict commerce in the material and equipment necessary to respond to the coronavirus, and harming ordinary people, the lawmakers wrote. In an article by the Middle East Eye, we witness millions of Iranians at risk as U.S. sanctions choke insulin supplies. A new tranche of sanctions imposed by the U.S. on Iran has exacerbated the insulin shortage crisis in the Islamic Republic and boosted its smuggling, patients and doctors told Middle East Eye. Human rights advocates have warned about the devastating consequences of the latest sanctions on the daily lives of Iranians, including blocking their access to essential drugs and food. According to Farza Peyrouyan, the secretary of the National Academy of Health Economics, there are 4.5 million diabetic patients in Iran, 600,000 of whom need a daily insulin shot. That's all for this segment. We'll see you next week.
Sanctions has already cost Iran about $200 billion in revenues and helps devalue the currency by half in the past 2 years, before the virus emerged. And it was mainly down to decimated oil sales. Modern Iran, after all, has traditionally been an oil economy. So the blow by sanctions, oil sanctions even, to the economy in the medium term, and especially while the country is struggling with a worldwide pandemic, should be obvious.
We are an oil-producing country and we need to sell oil. When they created hurdles for selling our oil, we had only one source to take from, which was the Foreign Exchange Reserve Fund and the money we owed from abroad. So we did not have a growing economy and did not have an economy with enough reserves. Well, to handle the coronavirus outbreak, shutting down the economy is needed. Elsewhere in the world, when they are under total lockdown, the unemployed are backed by insurance and will receive support.
Iran's crude oil sales of 2.5 million barrels per day, the U.S. tried to bring down to zero after pulling out of the JCPOA. That didn't happen, but Iran had to sell by running circles around the U.S., and that was up to only 300,000 to 400,000 barrels a day on a good day.
You said preventative measures such as wearing masks and washing hands were much better. Well, quarantining is one of those measures, isn't it? Why is it that Iran's economy hasn't been able to sustain a systematic, consistent quarantining?
Not only our economy, but also the economies of more developed and strong countries of the world, both in terms of economy and technology, have been unable to bear this. But I do not think we needed a long quarantine period. I think we needed timely quarantine, but not for a long time. We needed to announce lockdowns and eventually lift the restrictions carefully and with planning, just like what we did in April. Back then, Iran managed to rein in on new daily infections by imposing severe restrictions for 2 weeks, taking new cases to less than 100 people a day. But that plan was abandoned shortly after. As a result, unfortunately, we entered the second wave.
Iranian Foreign Minister Mohammad Javad Zarif tweeted that the U.S. had moved from economic terrorism to medical terror by declining to lift the sanctions after the beginning of the outbreak in Iran in mid-February. He urged the international community to stop aiding war crimes by obeying illegal and immoral sanctions.
Iran's plea for sanctions to be lifted on humanitarian grounds during the outbreak has gained traction globally. But to the US, where sanctions failed, the outbreak succeeded. And now's the time to deal Iran that fatal blow while it's still down. To make Iran capitulate to US demands, America not only didn't lift sanctions, but it doubled down, enforcing new sanctions, even as it offered Iran aid to combat the pandemic.
Iran refused the aid, obviously, because in Iran's view, all the US need do is lift sanctions as provided for in the nuclear deal, in which case Iran would need no aid. It could freely buy ventilators and so forth for coronavirus patients from any country it desired.
The bottom line is that the tough economic sanctions that the United States has imposed on our people have definitely affected patients. Acquiring pharmaceutical products and various diagnostic equipment, such as diagnostic kits, and radiological devices such as CT scans, MRI machines, and other equipment that need to be purchased from other countries is another important fact. To a large extent, these unilateral and highly inhumane sanctions seem to have seriously harmed our patients as well.
However much Iran may have suffered, the end result shows yet another failed policy on the part of the U.S.
While the U.S. could achieve some of its goals in short term, that is, it saw the impact of sanctions on Iran. But in the long run, this will be to the detriment of both the United States and its allies, because Tehran chose not to trust them in any way, neither in crisis nor in peace, and to base their trust on its only domestic production. All laws, which were generally import-based, are now moving towards supporting domestic production. Their disadvantage is that, in the long run, they will no longer have a country with a population of 80 million as a market for their goods.
By April, Iran was already losing at least 1 million jobs per month. That's right. And economists said the coronavirus would shrink Iran's GDP, gross domestic product, by a third and create at least a $10 billion budget deficit this year. People are suffering because a government lacking resources can't bail out businesses and can't keep up quarantines because it can't financially support people so that they won't have to go to work. But the country is still standing. And anyone who doesn't believe they can seek corona treatment, just please refer to any of the good doctors and their hospitals, which I just introduced on the show.
With the third or latest surge of the coronavirus, I have heard of people spending ₹1 billion on black market drugs and then hospital treatment. Compare that to ₹300 million, which is the maximum standard, more or less, in private hospitals. However, my own friends and one friend in each friend group caught the virus had no such experience. They may have not caught the strongest strain, but the treatment is the same and they got hold of enough drugs to get cured. And those who had to pay didn't have to break the bank.
Aye, the greater number of patients treated corresponds with the greater number of cases infected and dead. And with overflowing hospitals and mass graves, doctors will be pleading for medical supplies, although they shouldn't have to, as under international law, a country or coalition of states enforcing economic sanctions should consider the impact on the human rights of the affected population, especially regarding their access to goods essential to life, including medicines and food.
That's it for today. Thanks for joining us from the whole team. For now, it's bye.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Epic of 8-Year Holy Defense.
In the name of God, Salam and welcome to the program. If you remember, we discussed the admission of the Western and Arab media and regimes under all-out support for the Iraqi dictator Saddam during the 8-year war he had imposed on the Islamic Republic of Iran upon the order of his masters in Washington and then Moscow. Stay tuned for more, please. The French intelligence agencies estimated in 1986 that if Paris had stopped sending aids to Iraq for 3 weeks, the Iraqi army would have been defeated in the war. As the United States, the Soviet Union, and their satellites had imposed the war on Iran to overthrow the Islamic system, they didn't spare any assistance to the Ba'athist regime in financial, arms, and political terms. This while they even refused to sell barbed wire to Iran. The US and European regimes, especially France, Britain, and Germany, delivered enormous amounts of chemical weapons to Saddam, which he used both against the Iranian combatants and a few towns. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, as the president of Iran in those days, would often go to the battlefronts since the first days of the war. He says on the end of the 8-year holy defense, during the imposed war that lasted for 8 years, the US helped Saddam. NATO helped Saddam. The Soviet Union of those days helped Saddam. The reactionary Arab bloc, though it was very incompetent and weak, helped Saddam. Everyone helped Saddam. I mean, the East and the West had formed a single front for Saddam and against the Islamic Republic. Yet, the Islamic Republic didn't turn a hair. It stood and, with the divine help, overcame all of them and triumphed over all of them. After 8 years of war, they couldn't separate one span of Iran's soil. The leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, analyzing the Iranian people's exemplary steadfastness during the 8-year holy defense, says, "The Americans' aim of imposition of the war was to defeat the Islamic Republic by Saddam, to cause it to lose its reputation and say, yes, the Islamic Republic government and the Islamic Republic system caused Iran to lose. But the contrary occurred. In all the wars of the past 200 years with another country, Iran had lost. Yet, this 8-year war is the first war and the only war that Iran has defeated the other side and has not lost. A single span of the soil has not fallen in the hands of the foreign country. This is the first war, quite opposite to what Americans had desired took place." James Beale, a specialist of the issues of West Asia, says in his book on the war that the Iraqi regime hoped that it could nip the Iranian revolution in the bud. The Ba'athist army had invaded Iran's borders 636 times before the outbreak of the war on September 22, 1980. Saddam initiated the invasion of Iran, saying that he would reach Tehran within 3 days. He waged an all-out war with 12 infantry divisions, 15 armed brigades, 4,500 tanks and personnel carriers, 360 jet fighters, and 400 helicopters, as well as full military equipment. Contrary to his wishful thinking, his criminal army was bogged down as it faced the stiff resistance of the valiant people of Khorramshahr for 35 days. Although the Iranian army had little coherence in those days, and the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps had been established for less than 1 year and a half, the national unity among all walks of life helped people overcome difficulties little by little. One year after the invasion of Saddam's criminal army, Iran changed its strategy from defensive to offensive so that within 9 months, big swathes of occupied territories were liberated and Saddam's regime sustained crushing defeats. Without any doubt, the most important reason for those victories was the unmatched leadership of the founder of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him. Imam Khomeini's words and commandments were highly esteemed among people, especially the youth. There was a very profound bond between the Imam and the Ummah. This was the very matter that the enemies had neglected and, in fact, couldn't understand. Former head of the French spying agency, Comte de Morange, said on how much the West was scared of the Imam's leadership. Iran is one of the real powers of the region as it has huge oil reserves in its vast and populous territory. For thousands of years, this empire has been known as the dominant power in the entire region. Now, in the era of Ayatollah Khomeini, this power has multiplied manifold. The French official wrote in a message to Saddam, "As for this man, Imam Khomeini, be alert. Nothing is more dangerous than a forest that has caught fire, because strong winds will blow over it and the fire can spread to the intellectual borders and neighboring countries." The United States and its European and regional allies considered Iraq as the best choice for achieving their nefarious goals. The Iraqi Prime Minister in those days, Taha Yassin Ramazan, said, "This war is not for the 1975 Algiers Accord or several kilometers of land and half of Arvand River. This war is aimed at toppling the Islamic Republic regime." Lars Aspin, then head of the Armed Forces Committee of the American House of Representatives, also stressed that the U.S. strategic objective should be focused on stopping the expansion of Iran's radical Islamic revolution to the Arab world, even if it requires employment of military force. Face to Face. Dear listeners, what you hear now is an interview with Sudanese Information Minister Faisal Mohamed Saleh about ongoing developments in that country.
Thank you for joining us. Thank you for taking the time out of your busy schedule to speak to me. It's been 2 years since the Sudanese revolution. Since the protests began, what do you think has been the main challenges, and have people's lives significantly changed since the revolution?
I think that the transition itself, it's a challenge. It's a very big challenge for the government, for the Sovereign Council, and for the political parties. And if we study the experience of transitional period in many countries, it's always been very difficult time with a lot of challenges and obstacles. And we face the same challenges and obstacles here in Sudan. It was difficult even to change the mentality of the people, the ordinary people, the people in the civil service, in the governments, who used to be under dictatorship for military and dictatorship for 30 years. And at the same time, we have the problems of also changes in the military side, in the security, in the police department, in the army, which they are now partners. So all these were the difficulties we are facing. Some of them are expected already. We expect to have such problems. Some of them are new ones. At the beginning of the revolution and before that, people were hoping that we are going to have a full civilian transitional government and transitional organs. No one expected such situation of multiple military and civilian. So this is a new challenge. We found ourselves in a position where the civilian are negotiating with the army and they should be both on board. We were not prepared for that. The political parties were not prepared for that. The FFC, when she led the revolution, were not prepared for that. So this was a de facto situation that you have to deal with it. So this has also created new problems. Since this government came, we are trying to deal with these difficulties and challenges. I think we have been successful in some of them, especially, for example, in the side of peace agreement. It was a success, although, of course, some of the armed movement are still out of this peace negotiation. We hope that they are going to join. And the main challenges, I think, was economic one. And I will say, frankly, we were not successful in that. We still have a lot of problems. We knew from the beginning that we are going to have a very difficult economy, the old regime. And we had some ideas that we are going to overcome this problem. Unfortunately, and again, frankly, I will say that we were not successful in overcoming this problem. We're still suffering. Part of it, I think, will be solved because of the lifting of the American sanctions. Part of it, not all of it. But at least it will open doors for investment. It will open door for Sudan to rejoin the international banking system, which is one of the problems we are facing. But this is now is the main challenge, that the economic one.
And something you mentioned was you did not anticipate joining the military. You was expecting a full civilian government.
Yes.
What happened? How have we got to this situation where we have this kind of partnership between the military and the civilian government?
What happened is that symbolic, that the army intervened when they knew that the revolution will continue. And I think they have reached to the point where they think that the old regime cannot continue. And maybe they were thinking of if a new regime came, then there will be some negative aspects, negative result on the army, so they decided to intervene. So it appeared at the beginning that they are intervening in favor of the civilians, the protesters. But of course, when they did that, they asked for a share of power. And I think this is expected and natural in such situations. We have the same experience in 1985, where also the army intervened in the last moment, and so they were part of the transitional government. It lasted only for 1 year, but this time here is 4 years. So I think when they intervened, when they took the power and they ousted the old regime, then the civilian FFC found themselves in a situation where they have to negotiate. And there came the intermediate, the African Union intervened, Ethiopia intervened, the mediators came in, and it was a situation, as I said, it's a de facto situation where you have to negotiate with the army. And it was from that day, 11th of April 2019, people expected that the army will be on board with the civilian. The negotiation was what the share of the army would be and what the share of the civilians. And I think because of the balance of power, by that time we reached to this result. Again, maybe it was not anticipated, it was not the same, the type of civilian transition government that people were expected, but this is how things went. And so it started from August 2019, this civilian and military partnership.
And it's a process, the transitional period is a process, and at the end of the process, the hope and the aim is for a democratically elected government.
Yes.
But what's to say the army doesn't do the same thing again, and they once again try to share power with a democratically elected government?
I think that will depend on the balance of power. Because we had this, what we call constitutional declaration, and the constitutional declarations put an end to the military participation by the end of the transitional period, where we should finish the constitution, the new constitution, and we are going to have an election, and of course a new democratic government will take control. And the army will go back to the barracks, will be just doing what the army in the other countries do. This is what the constitutional declaration and the political agreement agreed upon. And I think everything depends on this balance of power. Because if the civilians are weak, then maybe the army will have a new ideas. But day after day, there is a progress on that.
And we've traveled to many places on our trips. And one of the places we went to is Mayo, one of the poorest neighborhoods in Khartoum. It seems like the economically disenfranchised, which seems to be getting larger, it seems to be growing. What message can the Transitional Council give to them about economic prosperity in the future, or at least uplifting them from the economic situation that they're in?
That is linked to two issues. One of them is political and the other one is economic. Political one is peace. Most of the people who are living in these areas came from the war-affected areas. And they are live in the margins of the big cities. And also, they don't have, some of them, most of them don't have a skill. They were not educated. So they are doing marginal jobs. And I think if we successful enough in implementing the peace agreement, most of these people will go back to their areas, where they are farmers or whatever the profession they have, and they resettle in their own areas where they have at least some peace and stability. That I think will improve the economic situation of them, because as I said, they will not be in the margin of their own life. They will be in the center of the life they are used to do, to live in the past. So this is a political fight, that if we have enough peace and stability and security in the war-affected area, people will go back to these areas and live ordinary life. The other side is the economic one. As I said, we were not successful in that till now, because we promised people of working on sustainable development, and that we are trying to find way where the people will at least find education, health care, without spending a lot of money on that. That would be the government responsibility. And we still, although we promised to start from day one to do that, we didn't fulfill this for them. Because I think most of the problems they have is with education and health care. They are spending a lot of money on that, although they don't have enough money to do that. So this is part of the program the government promised to do, to work on it, free education for all people of Sudan, and free basic health care. And that, as I said, because we were not successful in pulling the country from this economic crisis, we still couldn't do that. I think, as I said again, when with this lifting sanctions, the American sanction of Sudan, now we will be open for receiving help and fund from international finance institution that will help improving the country. Also, I think we are going to receive a lot of investment. Sudan is rich with its resources, natural resources, that will open door for investors. And rejoining the international banking system will also attract investors. I think with new investments, that will help improving the situation in the country and will improve the situation in these war-affected areas and the marginal areas.
So you mentioned the delisting of Sudan from the state sponsor of terror. Many international observers say that that had less to do with the compensation offered to American victims of terror and more to do with Sudan agreeing to normalize relations with Israel. What was your response?
At the beginning, that was not the case. We have started from day one. In September 2019, the negotiation with the Americans on the political and legal side of the this case of delisting Sudan from state sponsoring terrorism and the compensation for the families of the victims of terrorist act that Sudan, the old Sudan government, was linked to. And the issue of normalizing relationship with Israel was never, by that time, was never mentioned. We started, as I said, in September 2019. So the negotiation went on the political side with the American administration and with the victims' families, the legal side. And that went on for maybe 7 or 8 months. And it went on successfully until we reached the point where we reduce the amount of money that the Sudan government will pay for the as a compensation for the victims' families. In the last few months, and then, the question of normalization with Israel was raised. And what was not raised only with Sudan, as you may see, with Emirates, with Bahrain, with other countries. And we insisted on two things, that separation of the two issues. We used to say to them, and that was said to Secretary of State Bami when he came to Sudan, that these are two separate issues. Delisting Sudan from SST, we are negotiating on that on 7 or 8 months. Normalization with Israel is a very controversial issue. It could be discussed, of course. There's no problem in that, in discussing it in Sudanese media or discussion with the public, whatever it is. It could be discussed. But separated from the delisting of Sudan from SST, this is number one. Number two, Our response to him was that we are a transitional government. This issue is not one of our mandate. And that is what we agreed upon in the civilian government with the FFC. We had a joint meeting before a day before he came, and we agreed that this is not a part of our mandate as a transitional government. This should be left to an elected government to discuss it. Then the American pressure on Sudan started. Until that time, he didn't say that it was linked, the delisting with the normalization. But he used to raise the issues. Until maybe the last 2 weeks before the American election. And I think it was Sudan was used as a card in the elections. Trump wanted to have some cards in his favor. Part of it is convincing some Arab countries to normalizing relationship with Israel. So it was linked directly. Sudan was put under a very heavy pressure. In the last week, it was said clearly, this is linked. If you want Sudan to be listed, delisted from the SST, then you have to normalize the relationship with Israel. It was a very difficult situation. And the economic expert, our economics expert, our economic minister said that Sudan cannot tolerate the sanction for 7 or 2 months after election. If we said no, then we will wait for the election, then the new administration will have 6, 7, 8 months until they have done all the heavy duty that they are supposed to do, the homework, until they can discuss things with Sudan. This is a very long time Sudan cannot tolerate. So